Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of the Silver Shield Exchange. I'm your host. My name is Ryan Brooks. Joined, as always, by Chris Duane, SilverShieldExchange.com, Silver Shield Podcast at Hush.com is the email address to reach us, and Truth Never Told on YouTube for now. We have a very special guest joining us on the podcast for the first time this week. He co-authored The Money Bubble with James Turk. He's also written The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It, Clean Money, Picking Winners in the Green Tech Boom, How to Profit from the Coming Real Estate Bust, Main Street, Not Wall Street. After earning a finance MBA from New York University, he spent the 1980s on Wall Street as a Euro-dollar trader, equity analyst, and junk bond analyst. During the 1990s, he was a featured columnist with TheStreet.com and a frequent contributor to Individual Investor, Online Investor, and Consumer's Digest, among many other publications. He currently writes for CFA Magazine and manages DollarCollapse.com. Mr. John Rubino, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ryan. Hey, Chris. Good to talk to you guys.
Well, we're happy to have you on. I just gave the folks a breakdown of what we know about you from your website, but is there anything else out there for listeners who may not be familiar with you, John? What should they know about you?
Well, the main thing that you should know about me is that I've been involved with financial bubbles kind of inadvertently for the last 30 or 40 years. You know, I got interested in gold just in time for it to become a bubble in the late 1970s, and then worked as a junk bond analyst just as that market blew up. And then I was a tech stock columnist just as that bubble blew up and then burst. And then wrote a book about the real estate bubble just before that blew up. So I've kind of lived my life watching financial bubbles expand and then burst. And so that's kind of the beat. You know, as a reporter, that's what I cover. And so that's, if I have expertise in anything, that's it. Which makes it kind of topical right now because we're in the middle of another big bubble, the biggest ever, and one that's going to burst more catastrophically than anything else that has come before.
Right. And Chris, before we go to you, let's just jump right into it. I'll go through our first issue here and we'll get John's take and then you can kind of go from there. But talking about the biggest bubble of all, the debt bubble, our first article from Forbes written by Mike Patton, it says national debt tops $18 trillion. Guess how much you owe? Mr. Patton says this at the end of his article. Is the federal government getting in over its head? Will the mounting debt cause a financial hardship on Americans? As the debt continues to expand, the economy will continue to be sluggish, the tax burden will continue to grow, and the middle class will continue to shrink. If Washington does not act soon, will the debt become an unimaginable burden? The author believes that the answer to this question lies somewhere between absolutely and very likely. He goes on to say that he thinks it's going to be very bad unless politicians in Washington put politics aside and start making better decisions for the interest of America. So pretty interesting there from Mike Patton acknowledging, yeah, the debt's a big deal, but if we get politicians to do something, we can still fix it. John Turbino, what do you think about that issue there?
Yeah, that's all we have to do is get the politicians to fix it, right? You know, one of the ways that they've managed to blow these bubbles up is by lying about actually what is debt and how much there really is. Because when we talk about the national debt, usually in the mainstream media, as the guy you quoted does, they talk about the national debt, the amount of money that the government officially owes. But that is a minuscule piece of the total obligations that we as a society have taken on in the last few decades. You know, you've got, okay, the government debt, $18 trillion or whatever. Then you've got unfunded liabilities of Medicare and Social Security, which is really money that the government owes, but that it hasn't covered yet. And that's, you know, that the estimates of that varies, but it's somewhere around $100 trillion right now. You know, it's some immense number that just dwarfs the size of the economy. And then you've got the rest of the private sector's debt, which is a very real obligation of our country. You know, your credit card debts and your mortgage are just as real from the point of view of the U.S. economy having to satisfy the interest payments as the national debt, as the government's debt is. Then we've got derivatives, which are, without going to too much excruciating detail, are off-the-books financial contracts that the big banks use to gamble with. And the notional value of those derivatives is going on $1 quadrillion, a number which absolutely dwarfs the global economy. And some big portion of that is effectively debt as well. So if you add it all up, the average family in the U.S. owes millions of dollars to various people around the world, and there's no chance of us being able to pay it off. So, the writer in the article that you were talking about is right to be alarmed, but wrong about the solution, because there is no solution for debts at this level that isn't catastrophic. We have to get rid of them somehow, and the only two ways to do it are defaulting on them all, having a depression that makes the 1930s look like the good old days, or inflating them away by making our currencies worth less and less year after year until we have something that makes Weimar Germany look like the good old days. So, and there's no middle ground. There's no way out of this without some kind of an extremely, extremely painful transition. And so that's what we're trying to delay right now with all these extreme government policies of negative interest rates and massive deficits and coming capital controls, stuff like that. They're trying to delay that inevitability until they get out of office, till they retire and go off with their nice pensions and prestigious post-government lifestyles. You know, they want that before everything falls apart. And so they're doing increasingly desperate things to keep it going for another election cycle or one more year or whatever. But they won't be able to keep it going much longer because the numbers are overwhelming and reality is going to assert itself very, very soon. So that's our future. And it's a fascinating one from a theoretical standpoint, but a terrifying one for anyone who has to actually live through it and try to keep their finances intact.
Right. And Chris, as Patton says at the very end, he says, if we ignore the warning signs, if our officials maintain the status quo, there will be consequences. I only hope America realizes it before it's too late. Go ahead and take it from there. What's your thoughts?
It reminds me of when I went down to Ron Paul's last congressional hearing where I wrote the testimony. And afterwards, a young, 29, 30-year-old reporter came up to us and, you know, talked about, you know, those alternate currencies and stuff like that. And I said, you know, you're working for the Wall Street Journal. Are you aware that, you know, the dollar crisis is far larger than, you know, all these other, you know, bubbles and stocks and housing bubble and all that other combined, and that our dollar is actually debt? And she laughed at me. And I said, no, look here. It says Federal Reserve note. A note is a debt. I said, all money that comes into circulation is backed by a certain amount of debt. The Federal Reserve prints off the money, but it's backed by a government bond that has debt plus interest. And that the only way that this economy functions is that more debt every year has to come into the economy that exceeds the amount of debt and interest accrued the year before. I said, don't you understand that? And she goes, oh, well, that may be so, but that'll never happen. You know, like, and, you know, and this girl's working for the Wall Street Journal, and albeit she's probably some beat reporter that's on a shitty job, covering boring congressional things. But the very fact of the matter is that until people understand that our debt is money, there is no solving this problem. And John's right. There's only two ways of it ending. You're either going to have a default on the debt, meaning that all the agencies that owe the debt say we can no longer pay it, and no mas. Or there's going to be hyperinflation where they're going to continue to print more and more currency at a lesser and lesser value until the currency has no value. And even now in Greenspan, when questioning Congress, asking about our Social Security thing, says, oh, you can, you know, the congressman, can we guarantee all these payments? And Alan Greenspan says, absolutely. You can guarantee as much money as far out as you like. But he went on to say, but the only thing we cannot guarantee is the purchasing power of those dollars. And right there, I mean, it's right in your face, folks. Nations that don't print their own currency, such as Greece, are going to have massive deflationary collapses where they're going to have to default on these loans because they simply don't have the currency or can't print the currency to pay back these debts. Whereas other nations, such as Japan and the United States, you'll see, they do print their own currencies and their debts are denominated in them. And the only logical solution for them is to continue to print more currency to pay the debts, to keep the Ponzi scheme going. And then once the game is over, you know, it's the board's going to be flipped and it's going to be mass hysteria to set up a whole new system again. And either scenario, deflationary crash like the 30s, that John mentioned, or hyperinflationary like Weimar Germany, which is what I believe that we're going to go through. Either way, real tangible assets is the only logical solution that I see to preserve wealth, much less give you a chance to survive this kind of situation, because it is going to be nasty and people are totally not prepared for it.
As you said, it'd be better to have something than nothing altogether.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Greece, and that's our next issue here. This is from Yahoo News. One of Greece's largest banks says it will wipe away the debts of clients who owe up to 20,000 euros, or roughly $21,600, in a one-off gesture to ease the burden of its crisis-hit customers. The bank of, forgive me here, folks, Piraeus? Is it Piraeus?
I don't know.
The Bank of Piraeus, a Greek bank, decided to write off or restructure debts in response to the, quote, humanitarian crisis, unquote, through which its poorest clients were living, the company said in a statement. So debts of up to 20,000 euros linked to credit cards and consumer loans would be written off completely, while mortgage payments would be frozen and any associated interest forgiven. First, we'll go to you, John. What's your take on what's happening in Greece, and what can we take away from that being in America, watching that unfold over there?
Well, the important thing to understand about Greece is that the euro, which was set up about 15 years ago, had a fatal flaw in its original conception, which was that all these different countries got to run their own budgets, but they had to live under one monetary regime, which was going to be dominated by Germany. So all of a sudden, Greece had to live under a system that was defined and controlled by a country with a completely different culture. And early on, the markets made the mistaken conclusion that all euro-denominated debt was the same because it was all one entity, right? And so they allowed Greece and Spain and Italy to borrow as much money at rates as low as what Germany was borrowing. And so that naturally led to the bankruptcy of those countries, effectively. And so Greece is the biggest problem. They borrowed huge amounts of money. They lied about a lot of it. Now they can't pay their bills, and they don't have their own printing press. They can't make new currency in order to print their way out of this crisis. And so they're like a country back during the classical gold standard back in the 1900s. When you ran into financial trouble back then, you had to get real money from somewhere, and that controlled your behavior. But see, Greece's behavior wasn't controlled when they were taking on all that debt. And so now they're stuck with the consequences. So what will happen here almost certainly is that they'll cut some kind of a deal where they pay off a lot of Greece's debts, because that's a rounding error from the point of view of the European Central Bank. And they'll keep Greece within the Eurozone, but at the cost of the other Eurozone countries lining up for the same deal. Italy and Spain and Ireland and Portugal are all going to want the same debt haircut that Greece gets. And they're too big. That won't work. So they're going to trade an immediate crisis with Greece for a longer-term crisis with the rest of the peripheral Eurozone. So this story has legs. It's going to go on for a long time, probably, before the final resolution, which is either the dissolution of the Eurozone, where all these countries go back to their own currencies, or the effective takeover of Europe by Germany, in which everything is centralized and the power is in Berlin, and everybody else has to live under German rules. And I don't think either one of those are attractive scenarios from the point of view of the average European, so it's not clear how this plays out. But it is clear that they're not going to fix the Eurozone this week with whatever they do with Greece, that it's going to go on for a really long time until something much bigger happens. And probably it'll never get to that point because the global financial system will blow up before that.
Right. And before we get to Chris, let me ask you this, John. Do you see something happening in the U.S. as far along the lines like in Greece where they're actually wiping away people's debts? I mean, we have an enormous student loan bubble in this country. What is it, like $1 trillion of student loan debt, the credit card debt? We have all this debt here. Do you see anything happening as things get worse in the U.S. Those lines of people's debt being wiped away?
We're already doing that. You know, we have piecemeal debt forgiveness programs going on all the time here. And they're doing it with student loans, as you said, where they're making the terms easier, and they're making it easier and easier to in effect default and get away with it. We did cash for clunkers before. And of course, quantitative easing is debt forgiveness for banks, right?
Right.
So we're doing that. We're creating a lot of new currency and we're paying off people's debts. But we're not doing it on a scale that is saving us. Not that anything can save us, but in the minds of the people running things, saving us would be wiping out enough debt so that people can start borrowing money again and get us growing again in a, quote, normal way where new debts are taken on and then that money is spent for new stuff and then the economy grows, driven by consumer spending. Well, we need much bigger debt forgiveness for that to happen. And, also zero interest rates and negative interest rates are a form of debt forgiveness that allows borrowers to refinance at lower and lower interest rates and lessen the burden of their debts. So we're doing it in a lot of different ways. But at the same time, we're taking on new debts that are kind of negating the benefits of lower interest rates. You know, the world took on $57 trillion of new debt post-2009. After that crisis, when we should have deleveraged, you know, we should have started paying off our debts because we saw how debilitating excessive debt could be. Instead, we went the other way. And so the kind of debt forgiveness that is coming when these guys get really desperate will be astounding when we see it. You know, the term debt jubilee got tossed around a lot for a while there. It's going to be revived. And they're going to start talking about just QE for the masses, where they just come in and they print a lot of dollars and they pay off our mortgages and our credit cards. And that'll be kind of the final stage when everything really spins out of control. Because at that point, we'll see that we're functioning just by creating new currency. You know, we don't have a functioning capitalist system anymore where debt has meaning and money is borrowed for productive uses. Nothing like that will be happening anymore. And so we'll hit a wall that will look like the Austrian economics crack-up boom, where everybody figures out that all the fiat currencies are by explicit government policy being inflated away, and then we just give up on it. And that's the end game. We can't know when it's going to happen, but everything points towards it happening sometime in the next few years. You know, we can't keep going like this for much longer without an explicit debt jubilee, which will then kind of, you know, light the fuse that blows up the global financial system.
Chris, what's your take on this major Greek bank saying that's going to wipe the debts of its poorest clients?
Well, you know, I obviously agree with a lot of what John said, but there's another kind of factor besides the fact that, you know, our debt is money and that, you know, the amount of debt that is happening in there. It's also the concentration of wealth. You know, the Babylonian kings and the early Catholic Church, they recognize that it's not simply the amount of debt that is accrued that's a threat to the society, and that's the reason why they had debt forgiveness and debt jubilees, and you know, after 7 years, all the lands would return back to the people and stuff like that. In the meaning of having a sustainable, fair society without causing undue burdens for the people who get caught up in these systems. But the simple fact is that when you have a part of a society that is able to have, you know, all these, you know, contracts and no-bid contracts and military-industrial complex and Wall Street and Hollywood, and they're able to create profits that far exceed what the rate of return for the average person is, it's just a matter of mathematical time before a small group of people take all the real wealth out of the system, and it gets further and further up into the hands of the very, very, very wealthy. It's not the 1%. It's the top 10th of 1% or 100th of 1% that controls the massive amount of wealth out there. And, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, simply going, aha, well, let's redistribute it. The problem is the operating system that empowers these cunning men with these collectivist schemes that constantly are sucking from the bottom up to the top. And you can play this game with, you know, even your children. Play the game of Monopoly, where you own all the property, all the houses, and distribute all the money back out to all the impoverished people who are playing against you, and watch how many rounds it takes for you to get all the money back. And you can do it all over again. And that's what debt jubilees do. It doesn't change the balance of power because the game is rigged. The debt-based monetary system, the government confiscation through taxes and regulation and zoning and stuff like that, we're never going to see true freedom until there's true property rights back in here, and we have honest money and property rights and the rule of law once again. And I don't think it's capable of there's no amount of reform that's going to happen. There's too many vested interests. There's too much ignorance built into the system to ever have that happen. My only hope is that we have such a bad crack-up boom, as John said, with the Austrian breakup, that it rocks people to this core and gets them to wonder, why are we continuing to play the same game over and over again? You know, the reason why history rhymes is because we're playing the same song. We're playing the same collectivist games, these debt-based illusions, this ignorant masses with this cunning elite at the top. That's the reason why we keep falling into this game. And I think we have a unique opportunity with the internet and a broader spectrum of history and being able to connect the dots that the internet is allowing us to do. I mean, I never would have met John and I never would have met Ryan if it wasn't for the internet and all this kind of, you know, truth search that we're all going through. That until we have a change of consciousness in how we deal with each other and the natural world and stop exploiting things to its maximum extreme and stop taking advantage of individuals to the benefit of others and really start caring about, you know, how to live in, resonating with the world and with others, nothing is going to change. We'll repeat this exact same thing in the next 100 years if we don't learn these lessons.
And guys, one thing that's really important to understand is this didn't just come out of the blue. Today's world is exactly what you would expect to get if you put an unlimited printing press in the hands of a government, which is what we did in 1971. We broke the final link between the dollar and gold, and we, in effect, handed an unlimited credit card to the guys in charge of the global financial system. So human beings being inherently corruptible, these guys were inevitably corrupted by this almost absolute power to create new money out of thin air. And so, of course, we get a system where the governments and the banks are in charge of everything. And since debt is the product that banks sell, we're all deeply indebted. You know, if we put the car companies in charge of the world, then we would all have 3 or 4 cars, right? Well, the banks are in charge of the world now because the governments that they in effect run have unlimited printing presses, the ability to create unlimited amounts of money. And so until we take that away, you know, until we address the root cause of the debt buildup, you're right. We could have a debt jubilee here where we just forgive everybody's debts, start over, and we would be right back in this same mess again in one generation. So when this system breaks down, we'll have a global conversation about what we rebuild from the rubble, and the voices of sound money and constitutionally limited government will be up against the collectivist voices that say, well, this was a failure of capitalism. Therefore, we need a more powerful central authority to control the private sector. You know, so that it's going to be a really interesting argument, and it's not clear who wins. But those of us on the side of sound money and individual freedom should be educating ourselves now and trying to become as articulate as we can to sell the ideas that that the U.S. was originally based upon when the time comes, you know, when it matters. Right now it doesn't matter who's in charge because the institutional momentum of the system is going to take us off that cliff no matter what. But when it goes off the cliff, there will be a chance of rebuilding something that is more in line with Thomas Jefferson's original thinking. And that's going to be fun to participate in, and I think there's at least a good chance, not a great chance, but a decent chance that we can win that argument.
Here's another a point to it. I think it even goes beyond the intellectual foundation of what a new consciousness would look like, or a better society, or even getting back to what the, you know, founding fathers intended. I truly believe that you need to have the capital to do it. I think so many of these anarchist kind of guy, philosopher guys that are, you know, I watch on the internet, they're so wrapped up in the philosophy of it, they don't understand that you actually need the capital to build stuff. I mean, it's not, that's one of the reasons why I'm so, you know, perplexed about this whole Bitcoin thing, you know, with this illusionary wealth. I get the idea of transferring money and no fees and all that other stuff, but you know, at the end of the day, you need to have real capital to establish a new system. And at the very least, an individual needs to have real capital to provide a buffer from a very harsh reality where all of a sudden all values just got destroyed. You know, and what will humanity go back and value the day after everything fails? You know, what would people do? And to me, the answer keeps coming up over and over again, no matter how many different ways I look at it. Silver and gold are going to, you know, be that anchor when all things fail.
Yeah. Bitcoin is a payment system. It's mm-hmm. not money. And so it can be extremely useful because it's a payment system that, that bypasses the existing banking system. You know, so if you have your core savings, you know, the wealth that you're protecting in a risk-free manner in gold and silver, and then you use Bitcoin on top of that to make payments without keeping a huge amount of capital at risk in Bitcoin, that's, I think, a possibly healthy kind of hybrid monetary system. And so, you know, again, there's a chance we'll evolve in that direction as people educate themselves and figure out that, okay, gold and silver are real money, and the government can't create any more gold and silver, therefore it will, the supply of it will grow at a steady, predictable rate. It'll hold its value. That's where we want to keep our risk-free assets. Bitcoin, on the other hand, is an instantaneous, zero friction payment system that's really convenient to use, way better than a credit card or a bank checking account or something like that. Therefore, you know, keep our checking account in Bitcoin and our savings account in gold, and just bypass the existing banking financial system. That would be a really healthy development if more people picked up on it and started behaving in that way.
Yeah, instead of treating it as a, you know, a speculative thing where, you know, that it has real wealth. You know, I think I ran across Dwolla as another, you know, very little fee means of transporting, you know, wealth between accounts with no payment. I mean, it's a way that's coming. It seemed to me that Bitcoin came onto the scene as silver and gold were finally coming into their own, and the whole momentum shifted into these cryptocurrencies, thinking that that's the way that it was going to happen. And yet, when I looked into the history of it, I saw that, you know, the CIA is involved in it. I see that, you know, Rockefeller and Aaron Russo are talking about chipping people and electronic money. And, you know, if people get fooled into the next digital currency, which it seems to be the way it's coming, I mean, Goldman Sachs just to reveal that they're investing $50 million into a Bitcoin thing. Blythe Masters has gone to digital asset holdings out in Israel, which is a Bitcoin thing. All these libertarians who, you know, are claiming Bitcoin's fighting against the banks are going to find out that they just established the intellectual foundation for their next enslaved J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, you know, Bitcoin account.
And, you know, this also plays into the newest meme, which is the war on cash.
Yes.
Where governments are actively trying to make paper money obsolete because they want everything to be electronic. And on the one hand, that's because they need to push interest rates down even further if they're going to continue with their tried and true methods of stimulating a sluggish economy, because they've always pushed interest rates down and that's always worked. Now they're in negative territory and people are just holding cash instead of putting it in the bank. And that's that they call that the zero bound in economics. And that limits government's ability to push interest rates even further into negative territory. So now they have to make cash unattractive to own.
Demonize that, it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, on the actual bills, it says, you know, for all debts, you know, public and private, and yet you get banks like Chase, I think, in Cleveland, it says, you know, you can't pay your auto loan, you can't pay your mortgage with cash. I mean, how is that even legal? I mean, if you're going to change the rules of the game, at least change the law. But they're trying to demonize those that have cash, much in the same way that Google says, well, you know, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to worry about. And they're trying to make people who have cash seeming like they're all drug dealers. And, you know, we have every right to do, you know, protect ourselves with having physical notes, even though I think it's a ridiculous, you know, it's like grabbing onto a happy blankie or whatever to keep yourself kids safe at night. It's an illusion of real money. But still, it's one step better than having this digital money that is sitting in the bank. Where John is right, they needed to get the interest rates back in 2008. They said to a negative 6% rate, and that would have stimulated the economy and forced essentially stolen money from the banking account. And that was 2008. As John clearly pointed out, we've added $57 trillion on top of all the toxic debt that we had in 2008 when it was a corporate mess. Now we're dealing with a sovereign, structural, systemic mess that's going to be far larger. And these guys are all playing their chips right now to make sure that they get everything lined up as best as they can because they know it's coming.
These guys are incredibly desperate, the people in charge right now. It's not like they're operating with a financial plan here, because they're doing things that 10 years ago most economists would have said would be crazy. But they're doing it because they have no other option. They don't have any tools left. And that's on the financial track. And on the control track, what they're doing looks like part of a coherent plan, because each crisis is being used to limit individual freedom. And the whole war on cash thing is on one level about economic policy. On another level, it's about personal privacy and government control. Because once cash disappears and we're doing all our transacting electronically, then every single thing we do and where we do it will be visible to the banks and the government. And then we've created the turnkey totalitarian state, where somebody just has to flip the switch and total control is possible. So this is a very scary time, and it's also a really fascinating process from a theoretical standpoint, because this is the first time these guys have felt comfortable trying to go after cash in a really overt way. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out from here.
And I'll just remind people that, back in, 2008, Aaron Russo made a film called From Freedom to Fascism, where he detailed an explanation of a story or a conversation he had with Nicholas Rockefeller, one of the brothers of the Rockefellers, talking about how they were going to have this fake war on terror and having all these soldiers looking for ghosts and caves. And then, Aaron Russo said, why are you doing this? Why can't you, leave people alone, basically? He said, what's your end game? And Nicholas Rockefeller says the end game is to have everybody chipped, have all their money on a chip. And if anybody stands up to what we want, we shut off their chip. That's what they want. They want total control over human society. They don't want anybody upsetting the cart. They're planning for this. I mean, they're so close to it now. They have so much control over everything that we do, and yet that's still not good enough. And my contention is that, the human consciousness, the universe is not going to stand for this. They're not going to get the final clink on that chain to lock humanity in. I think that, the more time, energy, and money invested into controlling humanity, ultimately leads to to diminishing returns, which we're clearly seeing. It doesn't make sense to spend $1.5 trillion on all these weapons and technologies when we're clearly losing the image battle of the United States all over the world. I mean, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, every single country in the world signed up for it except for the United States and China. What are we going to do? Fight every single nation that didn't go along with the dollar scheme?
Well, see, and that's where I kind of wanted to jump in, guys, just to play devil's advocate and ask you this, John, because last week, Chris and I and our guests, we kind of touched on the evolution of humanity, where we're going with transhumanism and technology and digital money and those type of things. And I wanted to ask you, you look at the East and you see the physical wealth transitioning from the West to the East with real metals. You talk about how if we have precious metals and real wealth in the future, then that'll give us a great opportunity to try to build something better. But as a devil's advocate, I say to you, what is to stop them from, when they're done with the U.S., I mean, we're fat, we're morally bankrupt, financially bankrupt, or bankrupt in every way that you can spin it here. When they're finally done with us, what is to stop them from just deleting the debt and transitioning to a new global power run by these nations from the East? I mean, there's the opinion that Rockefellers have their hand involved in China, the Rothschilds, Henry Kissinger, those types are dealing and have dealt with China. This is all part of their plan. The end of the USA being the world superpower, which will transition into this global government, if you will. But so I just was kind of wanted to throw that at you randomly there, John, to get your take. What is to stop them from just deleting the debt and saying, hey, America, you guys are now slaves to China. This is how it's going to be. Like, what's to stop them from doing that?
Well, hopefully global public opinion will coalesce around, you know, this kind of point of view, and the 99.999% of the people who are disadvantaged by this use strength in numbers to stop it from happening. But yeah, there's no guarantee that that happens, because so far it's been going according to the script that you guys laid out a few seconds ago. And one of the interesting facets of this right now is that there's, at least on the surface, competition going on between the BRICS countries, right, Russia and India and China and the U.S. And a big part of that is because we've been really abusing the privilege of owning the world's reserve currency. We use it to build up a military empire that pushes these guys around and doesn't let them become the local superpowers that they think they deserve to be. And so they're doing a lot of things to lessen the power of the dollar in the global financial system. One of the things they're doing is accumulating a lot of gold, which either is just a good investment from their point of view, or is a form of real money that they intend to back their currencies with at some point and create stronger currencies than the dollar and gain the advantage for themselves that we now have by owning the world's reserve currency. We don't know for sure, you know, what their motivation is, but they're behaving as if those are things they're trying to achieve. And yeah, the Asian Development Bank, for instance, is one way of bypassing the dollar. You know, these guys can fund a development bank like that with their own currencies and then use those currencies to fund infrastructure programs and programs in Asia without any regard for the U.S. They don't need the dollars. They don't need U.S. permission to do this stuff. And to the extent that that spreads, that makes the dollar more and more fundamentally weak going forward. Because if a given central bank doesn't need its reserves to be 60% in dollars, if it can be 40% in dollars, that means they've got to dump an awful lot of dollars in order to get that rebalancing done. And so let that transition take place in a lot of different central banks, and that's a lot of downward pressure on the value of the dollar and on the power of the U.S. government. So anyhow, that's one underlying process that's at work out there. And as you guys said, there are other processes where the world's elites may see Asia as the future, and they're getting set up for that eventuality. And it's going to leave us as kind of a backwater at some point. So I don't know what that means for personal finance. Yeah. I think if these guys decide to back their currencies with gold, that you in the U.S. would want to follow their lead and also own gold and silver rather than dollars, because that's going to make the dollar relatively weak, and probably relatively weak in terms of precious metals. If precious metals are used to back yuan or the ruble or SDRs or whatever ends up being the next major currency out there. So and then it becomes a question of what the U.S. government does with gold and silver. I mean, does the war on cash, once it's complete, lead to a war on gold and silver, where they try to make these other forms of money so unattractive to own that we're all herded into electronic money? I don't know. You know, this is a story with a lot of moving parts, and most of them are very disturbing. So it's hard to tease out one central thread in all this, because it seems like there are a lot of things happening on parallel tracks. And maybe there's an underlying structure where they're all being guided by the same people. Or maybe it's just a bunch of somewhat incompetent people out there blundering around. It's hard to say at this point.
Well, one thing's for sure, times are changing. That's for sure. And I suppose, Chris, the reason why I threw that at John, and I know this is going to resonate with you, and I want to get your take on it, then we can move on. But as you know, I've got a very close friend who's in Korea now, and she's able to look at how the Korean people look at us. She's in the military, so she's able to see like how the Korean people look at the U.S. military, how they treat them. they treat them like kind of big dummies, like you guys are just kind of big goofy drunks. They don't really like us there. It reminded me of talking with another individual who was watching on television, this American, I think he was a cook or something. He was in China trying to talk to the Chinese people, and they were treating him like he was in the zoo, and he didn't get it. They were saying like, hey, do a Brooklyn accent, you know, like, duh, 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 duh. And the guy's trying to do Brooklyn accent, and they're laughing at him like he literally is like a little monkey or something. And so I thought, wow, you know, that really makes sense. The world really hates our country, hates the U.S. for what we've done. When the dollar bubble bursts and, you know, the end of the dollar happens, that's only going to make more people angry at us. And it would very easily justify just this, hey, the U.S. are just a bunch of fat slave people now. Like, they will build our phones so we can have in China the quote-unquote American dream. You know, I see that. Like, the difference is, I guess if you just really remove yourself from the American exceptionalist vision, which is really hard to do as an American, but to look at it how the world sees us, is that realistic? Like, where we are to you, like, you know, the world's zoo or something, just a bunch of fat debt slaves who live in a Hunger Games kind of world, and it's okay because we deserve it for everything we've done. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, you've definitely thrown a lot out there, and we've talked before about how there's been so many crimes that have been committed in our name that I don't think a lot of typical Americans understand, you know, how the world really views us. And, you know, I've traveled the world and I've had many experiences in, you know, in white nations that they don't like Americans, much less, you know, what's been going on in South America and Africa and Asia. I mean, we've been involved in multiple wars in Asia and, you know, regime changes and all sorts of dubious acts. Listen, all this comes down to, and I listened to James Corbett do a couple things talking about how the BRICS nations, the anti-hegemon, are actually just part of another Hegelian dialectic run by the Rockefellers and Rothschilds. And, you know, he cites a lot of, you know, historical data with Mao being involved with Yale and Rockefellers and, you know, knowing all these families and all that other stuff. And it's a very possible scenario that this could just be another Hegelian dialectic and that the, you know, the Anglo-American leader is simply just going to, you know, run over there. But it all comes down to is out of need. Robert Trifflin came up with Trifflin's dilemma, stating that a reserve currency has this problem where it has to keep on creating all this debt. But at some point, the debt becomes unsustainable. And the only way to deal with it is to cordon off that debt of the dollar and let it, you know, he put it in very nice terms like fall away or whatever, but basically default on the debt or collapse it and try to cordon it off. And that's exactly what's happening with this Asian Infrastructure Bank, where the world is setting up a whole nother system excluding the United States. And it could just be that the Anglo-American and the United States purposely kept us out because they want to destroy the dollar and rip the dollar apart so that they could be the carpetbaggers that come in like the Northerners did to the South and buy up all the assets, much like how the Rothschilds went into Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed and put up all these oligarchs of these young 20-year-old kids, and all of a sudden they're billionaires within 2 years. There's a very good possibility that this is a Hegelian dialectic. There's also the possibility that the SDR is, you know, I've heard Trump out there that the SDR, which is basically a basket of these GA currencies, excluding the yuan, that would be this currency. And, you know, I wouldn't understand why the Asian Infrastructure and Bank came to existence, mainly because in 2008 or 2009, when China was actually, you know, knocking on the door saying, hey, let us in, we're a major player into the IMF. And the IMF is like, no, we don't need you. So then I would contend with James Corbett and all these SDR people, all that may be true up until about 2008. And I think the 2008 financial crisis showed to the world what United States did to the world by selling all these toxic assets all over the world to these pension funds, lying and then bailing out their own people, spending money on cars for cash. I mean, I remember the Saturday Night Live clip of the president of China and the president Obama saying, oh, so you're saying that you're loaning money for people to so that we're buying your junkers, and you know, they're laughing at us, and the world doesn't see us that way. And my contention is that, you know, the anti-hegemon, that the BRICS are a legitimate counterforce there, and that they're not to be trusted. This is not like we're cheering for China and cheering for Putin. They're just other collectivists in charge of another scheme, and it's another lesser of two evils. But up until 2008, things changed. And one of the points that I pointed out in the Silver Shield group is there was a book called Currency Wars written by Song Hong Bing way before Jim Rickards or CIA, sound money guy came into existence and wrote his book called Currency Wars. Song Hong Bing predicted the 2008 financial crisis, properly called that the Western governments are not, political entities, but rather banker pawns. And he called out the Rothschilds. And that all these nations that are forming this BRICS nation have all suffered at the hands of the Anglo-American empire that's been run for centuries by the Rothschilds and Rockefellers and other Anglo-American banking powers, and suffered at the hands of it. The British colonization, the opium wars in China, even supporting the Bolshevik Revolution. And I would contend that there's a real animosity and a real willingness to let America suffer for all the sins that have been committed in our names. And in all three scenarios, whether the BRICS are a full-blown Hegelian dialectic, totally controlled by the Rockefellers and Rothschilds, or that this hybrid SDR system that's run by the Anglo-Americans, somehow limps into existence and is getting out of the dollar. Or my contention is that they're all evil and that, the whole system's going to go down one way or the other. In all three examples, the only logical solution for any individual is to have real tangible wealth, because that's what these guys are all playing for behind the scenes. We're seeing the massive amount of gold that the Chinese are buying, that the Russians are buying, that the Indians are buying, the three major partners in this anti-hegemon alliance. We're seeing JP Morgan continue to stack physical silver as the price of silver has been going down, on. And, at the end of the day, all these fiat currencies throughout all of history, regardless of who's in power or what schemes these elitists come up with, they all fail. And at some point, the new currency comes in and it's always based off of something real. And it's going to be gold. It's going to be silver. My contention is silver, simply because of the gold to silver ratio. So get to the end of this line and get back to silver.
I hate to be the bad guy here, guys, and go a different direction, because we've already gone almost an hour only on economy. John is the guy
about
to have on board
that's
to do
right.
it, that's for sure. So I'm happy to do it. But we got a couple other things just to touch on here. One of them being Jade Helm 15. Of course, there's more news about that. Before we get into it, though, let's hear from you, John. Like, what have you been keeping up with Jade Helm? What's your take on it? Do you care? Do you not care? What are your thoughts on Jade Helm 15?
That's something I really don't understand. why it's happening, why the local guys are responding to it the way they are, is a mystery. You'd think there would be communication that would be going on and kind of taking care of this kind of strange conflict. So I'll defer to you guys on this thing. I think it's, we're devolving into a police state. And so this might be one step on the journey, but I don't really understand exactly what it represents in the near term,
Yeah. And we cover it off and on. We've been doing so since it was announced last month. And I'll tell you, before I go to you, Chris, just for me, it's kind of like, deflated me a little bit just to see like Jade Helm. We should create a diaper line created by Jade Helm so you can literally wear the diapers as you research Jade Helm. So when you poop your pants, we'll be there to help you. Because Jade Helm YouTube channel, everybody wants 15 minutes of fame. Everyone's got thousands of views talking about Jade Helm. It doesn't even matter if you have a speech impediment. If you can't talk, just say Jade Helm, put your face on there. People are going to watch. And so now we've got the story. In case you didn't know, the National Guard in Texas has been ordered by the governor to observe the special forces and the military that will be conducting this Jade Helm 15 drill. Chris sent me the article about the citizens in Texas. Looks like one of the counties there, Bastrop County, they confronted a spokesperson for the military about Jade Helm. A lot of people were very upset. They don't trust the military. Why are these guys training on public land? So on and so forth. But I know Alex Jones just what did you say, Chris? He downgraded the terror threat level from they're going to invade Texas with martial law to this is just martial law conditioning. I know you reported that. But what else do you have for us with Jade Helm 15 this week and your thoughts?
I wrote the first thing in the morning, I usually wake up and I usually have some really good idea. And I wrote this piece this morning on the video, and I said, after the announcement that this was going to be, you know, just psychological conditioning to get the people aware, used to a military there, how 1,200 people in a nation of 350 million, how that's conditioning, I don't know. But I wrote this, I said, if this all was just a psyop, then I guarantee that it had everything to do about how social media reacted to this. Your emotional reaction to the unknown, your hysterical grasping onto the wackiest rumor, your further pushing away of people who would wake up if presented with logical and rational personal action. All these color revolutions in spring and Arab Spring were conducted mainly by psychological methods to destabilize societies, to radicalize those that were made to believe the absurdities to commit atrocities. At some point, it will either become too late or too dangerous to think or speak this way, and I'll be quiet during the anger phase of humanity burns. Take time to realize that this is a battle of consciousness. We are what we focus on. Stop fearing things outside of your control and focus on things that you can. And you're right, Ryan. It is very disheartening because, you know, I tried to speak in the most logical sense about this. I wasn't, you know, people saying, oh, you're slandering people and stuff like that. No, I was speaking logic to fear. And it's very sad that those that speak out are the ones that would attack logical voices. And it just brings me back to the most referred movie that you and I refer to, Idiocracy, where our man from the past gets in front of the court and lays out this rational, logical argument in front of the entire court and jury. And it was very impassioned and well thought out. And the entire court just saw him as a stupid person that talks like a girl. And that's what it comes down to. When you're on the internet, you know, you're dealing with a lot of people who just, they want to believe what they want to believe. And that's the end of it. And anybody speaking any different, you know, is stupid.
YouTube search Robin Sage. Just YouTube search Robin Sage. Watch the footage. This is nothing new. I'm not standing up for it. I'm not saying it's good, but they've been doing training like this with police in cities, with local people, doing all the things everyone's mad about. How dare they? They've been doing it for years. North Carolina, four times a year, every year.
Operation Urban Warrior had 6,000 troops in Oakland just prior to the first Desert Storm movie. The comments that I read there were that the citizens were happy because when the troops were there, the men in blue, the police, were on their best behavior, and that the citizens actually liked having the military there because it stopped the oppression of the local cops. Not to say that I'm for this posse comitatus, but whatever. I was in the Marines for 7 years. Maybe, and I think a lot of this has to do with that you and I, Ryan, are very, you know, have been on the inside of the military, know how dysfunctional it is and how, you know, these guys aren't these super soldiers that the hero worship that a lot of the people on the internet have. They're men with friends, you know, family and problems. And half of them are complaining that they, you know, that they're sweating too much or when's their next cigarette break. And it's not this Gestapo, you know, show us your papers or you're going to fry. We don't have that kind of mentality built into our military. You know, these guys are really loyal to the dollar and this illusion of American pie. And I don't think it's easily transferable to a demonization, killing of dissidents. And like, I just don't think that consciousness is there. So I don't want to belabor this any longer. Alex Jones degraded it. So I think we can kind of move past this issue.
All right. Let's jump on board here with son of a Bush. There's lots of Bush news. Apparently Shelton Adelson had his own primary, quote unquote, if you will, in Las Vegas last weekend, where he had some of the aspiring Republican presidential hopefuls there, such as Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Rick Perry, and others were there to pitch their plan, I suppose. But also in attendance was George W. Bush, as well as Willard Mitt Romney. And first we'll go to what George W. said. I know you highlighted this one, Chris, so I'll throw it to you and then we'll get John's take. But Bush criticized Obama, which he hasn't really done very much of, but he did criticize Obama's Middle East policies. And he said, quote, in order to be an effective president, when you say something, you have to mean it. You got to kill him. unquote. So there's other stuff on Bush, but we'll just throw it your way, Chris, and then we'll go to John with his take. What's going on with the Shelton Adelson primary?
Yeah, well, Shelton Adelson, if you remember my Secret Cause of World War III video that got, I don't know, 150,000 views so far, we highlighted a little comment from Shelton Adelson in front of this, I don't know, synagogue or whatever, talking about how they were going to, how he would deal with Iran and, you know, drop a nuke in the middle of their desert and say, hey, the next one's going to be in Tehran. There is a huge amount of money in this neocon warmongering policies that are coming in this next election. They've been very frustrated with Obama and their lack of war. And I've said this before that, you know, Dick Cheney, even as late as 2008, was trying to figure out some false flag to cause a war with Iran that Seymour Hersh reported on. I mean, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and he says that, you know, Dick Cheney was there trying to come up with ways of creating false flags to get us into a war with Iran. And this also goes to show that the president is decided by very powerful people way before the first ballot is cast. Who's the young Bush now?
Jeb.
Yeah, Jeb.
The
fact that he's already raised $100 million, even before he's even announced his presidency, shows that there's so much money behind the scenes to get started. And that buys a lot of friends, campaigning and power and local contacts that are going to be vital later on. And most people don't realize, they think like, oh, you know, once, you know, you can only raise like $1,000 or $2,000 per person. That's after you declare. And that's the reason why George Jeb hasn't declared that he's a president yet, because he can take $1 million checks from each of these guys, unlimited. Just to pile on the money. But once he declares, he's limited to whatever the Federal Election Committee does. So be aware that this is a big rigged game and that the true election has already happened. I mean, the fact that the Jeb got Mitt Romney, who, you know, was the front runner last time and clearly has the money and connections to actually make a credible challenger to Jeb. The fact that he had already dropped out way before, we were talking about this months ago, is something very, very big. And I think at the end of the day, you're going to have the Jeb and Hillary show.
John, go ahead.
Yeah, historians are going to mark this election as one of the signs of the beginning of the end of the global financial system as we know it now, when we have a Bush and a Clinton again. You know, and because one of the ways, or one of the signs that empires are falling is when things get extremely family oriented. You know, we have the same guys running the show and then handing off the power to their kids who continue to run the show. And that's what we've got now. We've got basically hereditary dynasties in charge of everything. And clearly that's an unsustainable system in what should be a democracy. And also, just as clearly, whoever's in charge, the policies are going to be basically the same. Because, yeah, the Republican neocons are mad at Obama. But if you look at his policies, they're not that different from Bush's. President Obama has ramped up surveillance beyond anything George Bush tried. They're now doing more drone attacks than they did under Bush, and they're rattling a lot of sabers. They're getting ready to invade a lot of places, even if they haven't done it yet. So I don't think it really matters all that much who wins the next election. The institutional momentum of the system is such that we're going to do what we're going to do regardless of who we think we elected. And so this system is going to come to its logical conclusion, regardless of what happens in any given election, state, local, or national. And so we have a certain amount of time left. We don't know how much time it is, but this system is running on fumes right now. It's on its last legs, and it's going to, one way or another, collapse under the weight of its own contradictions. And so we can view current electoral politics as signposts on the way, but we can't view them as any opportunity to change things, because things can't be changed. You know, we're going where we're going, And the only question is the timing. You know, how long does it take us to get there to the total collapse of the system? But there's nothing we can do to stop it on the way.
I suppose now would be a good time to officially endorse President Dwayne Elizondo Mountain Dew Herbert Camacho as my pick for president in 2016. If you've seen the movie Idiocracy, that's the president from that movie. Guys, let's jump on the other really big issue this week that we haven't touched on. Try to save the best for last, I guess. But when Chris brought it up to me in an email, he says, I've never seen so many Drudge headlines on the top at once. And that's obviously what's going on in Baltimore with the Freddie Gray situation. And it's just unveiling more and more stuff every day. I mean, we had the protests and some rioting going on over the weekend. The National Guard has been called in. Every day is kind of it seems to me people are kind of on edge. We don't know. I find myself looking at the end of the day to see, is there anything hot happening in Baltimore, in New York? But really a lot of stuff going on there. Listeners don't need me to go into detail. It's everywhere, but let's get your take first, Chris, from you. What's happening in Baltimore right now?
Well, what I'd like to have seen is, unlike a lot of these other protests and stuff, that the focus is on the economics and the kind of the system as opposed to the actual crime. And I thought that the VP of the Baltimore Orioles, I forget his name, John Angelos, wrote out this beautiful little summary saying, you know, it's not the property damage. It's not the crime, that he's most concerned about. He's concerned about the past 40 years about how this, political economic elite has shifted all of the jobs over to these communist, third world nations like China and impoverished, the American people, selling them out. And that we really need to reevaluate what we have spawned on every level. And this is a battle of consciousness, what we support actively every day. You know, it's fine for Apple to go all over the world, earn unlimited money, pay no taxes, and give us cheap, iPhones to track and trace us at all times. But yeah, we don't think about the alternate side of that, of, you know, not producing in the United States and maybe not focusing all of our time and energy on. If you look at where most money is spent, it's spent on killing people. I mean, it's for a fact. I mean, a trillion and some odd dollars are spent every year in the military industrial complex budget, figuring out how to kill people better, faster, and doing all the other stuff. And then, what's next? Money into the surveillance and social media and video games. And we're not investing our money wisely. We're not building sustainable power sources. We're not building, healthy food. We're not educating people to become their highest potential. We're indoctrinating people to fit into collectivist schemes, and it's leading people to be living very depressed lives because they're not realizing their full potential as human beings. They're just, buying stuff. They're consumers, and it's not sustainable. So until humanity starts consciously focusing our time, energy, money, what we support on a daily basis into things that are more sustainable and resonate with us, we're going to continue the sad drama over and over again. And it's not just going to be in Baltimore. It's going to be all over the world because the whole system is unsustainable.
Right. John, what's your take on what you've seen in Baltimore?
Yeah, well, I think there are two main aspects to the Baltimore story that apply to basically everywhere else in the U.S. And one is, our embrace of free trade. After World War II, a lot of people migrated from the South to northern cities because there were great jobs there. You could go to work on an auto assembly plant or most any other kind of factory and make middle class money and lift your family out of poverty in one generation. And then we embraced free trade, which I have to admit, I liked the idea of back in the day, where, we're a big self-confident society and we want to break down trade barriers and have everybody do what they're best at in the world. And from an economic theory standpoint, it's a great idea, but we, as it was implemented, we cut free trade deals and open markets with societies where there was, a billion people were willing to work for a dollar an hour. And that made it completely reasonable from the point of view of corporate CEOs to move their factories over to China or wherever, cut their costs by 2/3, pay themselves massive year-end bonuses for making all that money, and then lay off all their local workers. So it decimated northern cities and then led to all the kinds of corruption and cronyism that Chris mentioned. And that leads to a lot of the desperation that you see in big cities right now, because people know they don't have any prospect of getting a decent job and living a middle class life, and they see their society just crumbling around them, you know, neighborhoods becoming overrun with drugs and gangs, et cetera, et cetera. And so they're desperate, and that's where you see this anger bubbling up out of seemingly nowhere. All of a sudden, a city will just explode. Now, at the same time this is going on, technology has made it possible to see what actually happens between the cops and black guys. You know, it's been easy for white middle class people like us generally to say, well, yeah, okay, there's police brutality, but it's kind of exaggerated, I think, because I never see anything like that. But the fact is, living in an inner city, you see it all the time. And now we're finally seeing what it's like, because everybody has a video camera in their pocket now. And so every day, it seems like, a new video comes out of a white cop shooting a black guy for no good reason and then trying to cover it up. So apparently this stuff has been going on forever, but we're just now seeing it. And that adds to the anger, obviously, because whereas in the past you might have heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody else, you know, and that it made you mad, but it wasn't something you could see. It wasn't visceral. And now people in downtown Baltimore or whatever can go to YouTube and see somebody being killed who could be them, you know? And so it really lights the fuse to a powder keg that we've already created for economic reasons. So it wouldn't be a surprise, unless a lot of this stuff changes in a hurry, to see this summer be a very hot summer in a lot of cities where more stuff pops up on YouTube. Yeah. And more people lose jobs because the economy actually isn't growing. You know, we didn't really touch on how a lot of the economic numbers are kind of false right now. And the U.S. economy is actually flatlining in a lot of ways, especially in manufacturing, which was the source of good jobs for people in the past. And so you're going to see a lot of anger very possibly bubble up, and we're going to see a lot more Baltimores. Unless some of this changes in a hurry, and it's not clear how it changes, you know, how do you make dramatic institutional changes this quickly when apparently it's been the way it is now for decades? You know, it's not clear how we fix it right away. And unless we fix it right away, Baltimore is just going to be a sign of things to come.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because now the Department of Justice, as of today, has already announced a body cam program. You have people like Al Sharpton calling for the feds to take over policing, to fight states' rights. This has to be federalized. So to me, it almost looks like the solution being presented to our problem, which, as you noted, it's been a long time. Chris, let me ask you. I'm looking at the media like they're stoking this fire. But what do you think? Are they well, doing that, or?
You know, if we're always viewing things in Hegelian dialectic simply because that's what, you know, how all this progress happens. And I mentioned earlier how this Jade Helm thing could be, if it was a psyop, it's exactly what they would have done. You know, the Anglo-American Empire has done in Eastern Europe with all the color revolutions, stoking, you know, media frenzy. Even the Arab Spring, they were talking about that. There's a good possibility that all these things are going to be used as a cover for a, you know, systemically horribly debt-ridden economy imploding. I even said in the Three Coming False Flags video that I did on YouTube that, the criminal elite would love to have a scapegoat for their incredibly flawed system that's going to rip apart this nation. They don't want to be responsible. You know, they were the ones sitting on top of the power. Right. You know, they would love to blame, inner city riots for, blowing up the economy in the third quarter or fourth quarter or whatever it is. They would love to blame China or Iran or, some cyber hackers so that they can come in with these draconian laws, monitor, I don't know, the internet even further, or clamp down on banking, or, make cash illegal. They would love to have, any number of these things. The question that I think John brings up is, we live in an age of the internet, and it's not like the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, even 2000, where, you know, a lot of these things happen, these false flags or these, kind of nefarious things would happen behind the scenes. And, you know, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, you know, I wonder what would happen, you know, if the internet existed back then. I mean, it came out, what, 50 years later that the Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened? I mean, and yet, you know, how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of Vietnamese died because of a lie that day? You know, we're living in an age of the internet where humanity is consciously moving towards something different. And, you know, as much as these guys want to play and plan and plot and maybe take advantage of the situation, you know, Hillary and Rahm Emanuel both said, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. As much as they would like to do that, I think that the age of the internet and global consciousness and people are waking up to these schemes, and I don't think they're going to be able to get away with what they probably would have gotten away with, you know, even 10 years ago.
I've got one more article for you gentlemen here, and we'll go to John first with this one. Phyllis Schlafly warns America may be at the breaking point already. And this is in regards to immigration. The Census Bureau projects that the U.S. immigrant population will grow nearly four times faster than the native population. It will reach 15.8% by 2030 and 18.8% by 2060, at which time there will be 78 million immigrants in the United States. By contrast, there were only 20 million immigrants in the U.S. in 1990, accounting for 7.9% of the population. Schlafly believes that the grand old party could decline under a flood of new immigrants, but also the country. She said that we may be at a breaking point already, I don't know. She says that she's a Reagan optimist and doesn't believe America will totally collapse. So basically, Schlafly, I don't know if you read the article, John, but she's putting a lot of blame on Obama, letting a lot of immigrants in. They don't care about America. They don't want to speak English. We're purposely being overrun by immigrants, which will then be Democratic voters. And she says we could already be at the breaking point. What's your take on what Phyllis Schlafly is saying as far as in regards to immigration?
I think, first of all, extrapolating any trend out to 2060 is kind of wasted effort, because we can't possibly know what's going to happen in 2060, you know?
Yeah.
2020 is hard enough. But immigration is one of those things where both sides have a point, and yet both sides kind of talk past each other. People coming here from other countries are not an invading army. They're doing what we might have done in the same circumstances. They're going to where the jobs are in order to support their families. And so we should respect them from that point of view. You know, they're not scamming. They're working at jobs that most of the rest of us would never dream of doing. They're making a pittance, and they're sending it, most of it, back so their kids can eat. So they're good people. On the other hand, a country that doesn't control its borders isn't actually a country, right? That's one of the definitions of a nation, is it's an entity that has control over borders. So we should have immigration laws. Well, we do have immigration laws, and we should enforce our immigration laws, and we should have a say in who comes and goes. And I could totally see a work visa program where people come, work for 2 years, and then go back home or whatever. And, you know, so we get the benefit of these really hardworking people, but we have some control over who they are and when they're here and everything. So I think there's a potentially viable legal system out there that governs immigration. And there are a lot of reasons why it hasn't been put into place. And one of the main reasons is that both sides benefit from unrestricted immigration. You know, the Democrats get a lot of new voters, right? And the Republicans, who own the majority of businesses in the U.S., get super cheap labor.
Right.
And so it's in everybody's interest not really to settle this thing. And so I think that there's virtually no way under quote unquote normal circumstances that we avoid having a lot of people come across our borders and, you know, work here for a while or settle and live here. On the other hand, I think if we see a financial crisis coming, then that changes the calculus for immigrants, right? Because in the medium case scenario that most of us on the sound money side of the argument see coming, there will probably be fewer jobs here in the future, just because so much of the malinvestment, so many of the things that shouldn't have been created and have been created with borrowed money are going to go bust in the next decade. There won't be the incentive for people to come here that there is today. And so the immigration thing is going to be very different in the context of a financial crisis than it is in the context of a massive financial bubble. So I think this is one of those things that, that's going to change as external events change. And so whatever fix we try to put in place today probably won't be the right fix for 10 years from now anyhow. So it's one of those issues where we don't really need to expend a lot of energy on it now, because whatever we come up with will have to change dramatically when the world changes.
Yeah, and we've talked previously in our podcast about, you know, forget about the immigration problem, forget about the you know, power shifting to the east, forget about the, you know, the dollar collapse, forget about all this other stuff. You've got to also take in consideration, if you're a parent of a child, that within 20 to 30 years, the technological advancement to the point where, you know, articles are out there saying that half of all the jobs that exist today are simply just going to be automated. And, you know, the ramifications of a humanity that no longer has the ability of using their labor to produce value and wealth to bring it back into their families, I think it cannot be understated about how detrimental and historically shifting that is, not only to the average person, but the ability of those that own those robots and be able to, you know, the means of production. You know, the middle class, I fear for the American middle class is really gone forever, because we've empowered, you know, people who were seeking to, dominate, control, you know, societies, their own business, their own industries. And we don't have men like, you know, Henry Ford that really, you know, wanted to raise the standard of living around of people. You know, so that there's just so many factors. And John, I feel like, you know, once this collapse happens, it's all bets are off, like, for a generation. Like, I don't see, you know, I don't think like the next collapse, it being like a 1990s recession or, you know, 2001 recession or, you know, 2008 recession or whatever, or even the Great Depression. Like, once this fire is lit, we're talking about systemic generational shift in power and wealth, and technology. And that I really implore people to really appreciate what a special, incredible time we have right now to take advantage of the time that we have, the opportunities that we have to change or do something. Because once the fires are lit, I don't think that people will be able to travel like they used to. I think travel could become dangerous again. That the what is valued in society all of a sudden will be not valued, and things that haven't been valued all of a sudden value. It's a huge amount of things to take in consideration. And I really, you know, all these podcasts and talking with all these different people is really to get people motivated to take personal action, because there is no, you said it before, there is not going to be a collective solution. You know, if we came out with some philosopher king that decided to fix the inner cities today, it would take a generation for it to you know, filter through and heal all the psychological damage and broken families and do all that other stuff. It's going to take time to do that. And that the only solution is the individual solution. What can you do to protect yourself and your family and those that you love and care, you know, from these oncoming realities that, you know, I think we have a very, very good chance of seeing very shortly.
You know, the whole automation angle is a really fascinating separate aspect to all the stuff we're talking about. Because, you know, mm-hmm. you've got financial crisis coming, yada, yada. We get that. But the those things have happened in the past. And so in that sense, it's kind of understandable. But we've never seen this level of automation coming at us. Artificial intelligence is finally happening. And it's animating robots and expert systems and other kinds of services and processes and devices that replace people on a really vast scale, all kinds of knowledge work and transaction business. is being automated as we speak. You know, banking is just going to be wiped out, huge sections of it at least, by automation. You know, and Bitcoin is a good example of that, because it's making a lot of banking functions unnecessary. And crowdfunding, same thing. Do you need to be a loan officer when crowdfunding really gets going? And that is going to change the calculus for labor market economics at a time when it's already going to be really tough, because we've got a financial crisis coming. So an artist friend in New York sent me a painting of his a while ago that showed people protesting for higher wages with give us higher wages signs. And they were marching past a store where robots were on sale for 50% off. And the point being that, people are succeeding in a lot of ways in getting higher wages just lately. You know, higher minimum wages are being passed, and McDonald's and Walmart are offering their people more money at a time when these same corporations realize that robots are able to replace more and more of their workers. So their calculation might be that, yeah, sure, we'll give you a higher minimum wage for a couple of years, and then we'll completely replace you and everybody like you with burger flipping robots or automated stores or whatever. And so when that happens, then everything changes, especially for the lower rungs of the economic ladder, because all of a sudden these basic jobs that you used to be able to get and then use to develop job skills and move on up are going to be gone. And so are a lot of the middle range jobs on the economic ladder. And it's not clear how we replace those jobs or what we replace them with, or how those people eat who used to work in those jobs and now just don't have anything in their entire field that even exists anymore, let alone, you know, is available. So that's another angle that is really interesting going forward. And also where there's not a clear answer. You know, there's just so much stuff, so many moving parts to today's world. And so few of them have clear answers. It's almost like we're approaching Ray Kurzweil's singularity, where the past is no longer any kind of a guide to the future, because things are changing so fast. So, I wish I had more concrete things to tell people, because it's not really helpful to say, well, who knows what's going to happen. But unfortunately, that's our situation right now. You know, so much is unclear. We just can't predict the future with any kind of certainty. I just posted something with the title, "The End is Near, Part 2, Everyone Piles into Junk Bonds." And so there are so many different signs that the end of this process or the end of this cycle is nearing. And the war on cash is one of them, where governments are so desperate, they're literally trying to make cash illegal. And from a financial market standpoint, the flight into high-risk assets is another one, where people who used to be low-risk investors like pension funds and individual retirees are now piling into equities, and they're piling into junk bonds because there's nowhere else to generate any kind of income. And that is, historically, that's been a sign that the cycle is nearing its end. When you get the final dumb money flowing into high-risk assets just in time for those assets to blow up. And so the fact that junk bonds are now the darling of pension funds and individual retirees is a possible sign that we're reaching the end of this cycle and that another big crisis is coming. So I think that's the kind of stuff we need to pay attention to now, is the behavior of formerly risk-averse money in light of governments attempting to push that money into high-risk assets. And their governments are succeeding. They're pushing us into stuff that we should never be buying if we're retirees or mainstream mutual funds or pension funds or even a lot of hedge funds. You know, everybody's taking on too much risk. And that's the kind of thing that blows up bull markets. So we're getting very close to the end of this if these old indicators are still valid.
Yeah, I mean, look at what happened in 2008. We had all these, you know, really toxic debts that were sold as, you know, prime, investment vehicles all over the world to, you know, massed all over the place. And that's exactly what blew up in 2008, coupled with the fact that, the housing bubble, well, you know, they blame the low federal funds interest rates. Well, you know, the Fed funds rate has been, you know, below what it was that blew up the housing bubble. for far longer, and they can't even fear breathing that they might raise a 0.25%, because that would blow up the economy even further. So this war on cash, John's right. They want to go negative interest rates. They want to go below zero, that there will not be any massive, interest rate hike in the future, because the debt loads are double what they were in the 2008 financial crisis. And magnitudes more in the hands of larger players that are truly too big to fail. We're talking nation states now. It's not some JP Morgan AIG that we're dealing with. We're dealing with you know, the ECB blowing up possibly, or Japan with their Abe economics, and then just wait until the United States gets their taste back of QE when this when the economy starts turning negative again. John's right. Like, I don't know how many more warning flags that we need before it happens.
Yeah, and it all comes back, I think, in the end game to fiat currencies. These guys can keep on playing these games as long as they have currencies that everybody accepts as money. That means they can just create a bunch of new currency, put it out there for real stuff, and then keep the game going. But when, for instance, let's say the Eurozone starts to spin out of control, when too many countries run into trouble and demand bailouts, or you know, the de-dollarization in Asia gains momentum and people start selling off dollars. You know, there are a lot of fiat currency related crises that can happen out there, and let one of them happen to a major fiat currency, and then that calls into question the whole concept. People start looking around saying, wow, if that happened to the yen, could it happen to the yuan? Could it happen to the dollar or the euro? And they start looking around for who's next. And and then the game ends, because everything depends on these currencies working. All the other asset classes that exist out there all function within the environment of fiat currency. And let fiat currency be called into question, and then it's game over. And so, as you said, Chris, it's countries now that are running into financial trouble. It's not companies or sectors. It's the whole show. And so we're heading for a crisis that involves sovereign debt blowing up. And again, John, we can't know when it's going to happen, but that's coming too.
John, one of the things that I found most interesting over the past, I don't know, 9 months, and considering your name of your blog is called dollarcollapse.com, yeah, is the run-up in the dollar. And people are going, oh, you know, see, the dollar's becoming stronger. What's your take on what's going on with the dollar and oil? And, you know, is this really a sign of the dollar becoming super strong? Because all I see is very bad negative news about the existence of the dollar, and yet it seems to rise as if, you know, it's unstoppable.
Yeah, if you just looked at U.S. numbers in a vacuum, you would say the dollar's doomed immediately. This is completely unmanageable. This currency has to be devalued by 50% today for this society to survive. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's happening not in a vacuum, but in the context of a world where everybody else is even in worse shape. You know, you look at Europe and why would you ever invest in euros right now, when the whole system is in danger of spinning apart? Or China, where they borrowed $15 trillion in just the last 5 years, which is an amount that's bigger than the entire U.S. banking system. And they use that money to buy all kinds of things that aren't generating anything like the cash flow that's needed to pay off the debt. They've got these ghost cities there that where nobody lives, you know, so all of that money was in effect wasted. And so, and they're kind of an authoritarian society with unfree capital markets to begin with. So why would you hold that currency? Well, the answer a lot of people are coming to is that you wouldn't. And so you move your money into the U.S. by buying treasury bonds or equities or Miami condos or Manhattan penthouses or whatever, as a safe haven, as a place to hide out, because in the absolute worst case scenario, the U.S. is one coherent system with one currency and one central bank, and so they can pay you back just by creating enough new dollars to cover whatever they owe you. And so you're worried about return of capital rather than return on capital at this point. And to the extent that the whole world is thinking that, that's good for the dollar in the short run. But of course, a strong dollar is bad for us in a lot of ways because it hurts our export industries. It makes it harder for U.S. multinationals to export stuff to the rest of the world. And we're seeing that now with corporate profits being kind of sort of okay, but mostly because of financial engineering, and corporate sales going down. And you can't have rising profits forever without rising sales to go along with it, which means that corporate profits have to plateau and then start to drop, which means equity prices are extremely at risk. You know, so we're on the losing side of the currency war, in other words, right now, by accepting a higher dollar. And that never lasts. Companies or countries that have an extremely strong currency tend to run into trouble and then have to devalue their currencies. So that's the next part of this cycle, is where the U.S. starts to slow down. And instead of raising interest rates, the Fed turns around within the next year and has to start lowering interest rates even further and adopting new QE programs, et cetera, to devalue the dollar. And then who knows, you know, because the rest of the world will still be very weak and very badly managed, but their currencies will be going up versus the dollar. And anyhow, instability is the only thing that comes from all of this. You know, we're going to have volatility and crazier stuff happening until it all spins apart. And when, that's the only question, or the when and what is the immediate cause? You know, what's the catalyst? So those are the two things that that will be answered in the not too distant future and that we can't know right now. You know, it's going to play out in probably very unexpected ways. But the end game is the failure of all these fiat currencies, you know, and the discrediting of the whole concept of government mandated currency and government controlled printing presses, et cetera, and then we'll have to go back to some kind of sound money or a totalitarian system where we don't have any choices in the matter and everything is just what the government says it is. So one or the other, you know, that's what will come from the coming crisis.
Yeah, it's either, you know, further down the insane hole or maybe we lift our heads up and go, oh, wait a minute, what are we doing? You know, I keep trying to come to some kind of conclusion that, you know, if you take it through this kind of logical progression of how unsustainable the system is and, you know, calling into question, you know, what fiat money is, and then maybe we'll call into question why we have privately owned central banks, and maybe we'll call into question why we have such a large federal government, and I think we'll be forced to deal with the things that are real in our lives, and power is going to devolve down to the most local and responsive level. And I think there's going to be a myriad of solutions that are going to be offered throughout all of humanity and all of society. And I think it's going to take from this collapse, there's going to be a lot of seeds for that are going to germinate much in the same way. You know, we've had spiritual awakenings in the past and you know, new inventions proffer forward, you know, like during the 20s and stuff like that. You know, it's my contention that, yeah, the breakup, the crack-up boom or whatever is coming is going to be very nasty, but that's not going to be the end of the human story. And I think that, you know, after the fires burn out, I think that there's going to be very fertile fields to birth lots of new ideas. And you know, despite all of the negative, you know, really bad news that's on the horizon, you know, I'm very hopeful that, like in any personal story of somebody hitting rock bottom, that you know, individuals can and do come up from very hard situations, learn very hard lessons, and end up becoming incredibly productive and inspiring people. And I think so as the individual goes, so too do the societies that the individuals make up. So
look at you. Are you willing? Have you given up? Have you even tried? Do you really believe such an incredible one-of-a-kind creation such as yourself exists here to pass from birth to death without creating something equally one-of-a-kind? The answer for all of us is no. In the privacy of our own minds, we all have ideas, dreams, and visions that we know are great and would be wonderful creations to present to the world. We all believe in our solitary moments that we, too, came here to do things in and with our lives that will live forever. Few, though, have the kind of courage it takes to bring them to life. Fear of losing and embarrassing ourselves keeps us from showing the whole world what we came here truly capable of. A whole lifetime many of us will live, keeping the greatest parts of ourselves hidden. As we go on with our living, There may be secrets we will want to keep to ourselves and take to our graves, but the unique creative genius within you is not one of them. In fact, what right do you have to not use the creative gifts you are endowed with? Some of you don't believe you own your life anyway. You think God owns it. And about that, I would agree with you, he does. Although my explanation of how he does not involve faith-based, guilt-ridden, mindless servitude. Anyway, the point is, if you don't believe you own your life, if it's not your property, who the hell do you get off thinking you can misuse and waste it? Who the hell are you to throw its potential away? Is there no sin in that? You are not created the way you are to come here and squander it. When was the last time you really stepped off the merry-go-round of the world circus and took a long, hard, and honest look at yourself? What's driving you in your life? Are you doing what you are in your life just to keep up with all the mundane activity, the routine haphazardness of your life as you penciled in for? Or are you doing in your life what you really want to do? Who's giving you your life directions? Who is really designating the course your life is on? Is it you, or is it others? Someone else? What do you spend more time and energy doing? Listening to and following your own impulses and profound truths, or handling and processing the bullshit from others it takes to make a paycheck, to pay the bills, to sustain a life that gives you no joy or satisfaction? Are you using the powerful creative instruments within you to create an artistic life of everlasting meaning and inspiration? Or are you using the mechanized contraptions the other drones of the world use to live life as a tool and nothing else? Don't do a lot of nothing that really matters in your life only so you can afford to spend on stuff that doesn't really matter. By the end of your life, be able to say, I'm spent. I gave everything of myself that was unique and great. I've nothing left in myself or of myself to give that really does matter. I'm done, and I'm ready to go. That's going to do it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Special thank you to John Turbino at dollarcollapse.com. Please check that website out, dollarcollapse.com. And we'll see you next week. Until then, keep stacking.